Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. A couple weeks ago, I thanked a number of websites that have been directing a significant amount of traffic our way. I was remiss in forgetting to note that we get a fair amount of publicity from Religion in American History, a group blog on American religious history and culture, which we're going to link to on our website. For those of you who are interested in religious history, this is a great website to visit and includes one of the historians we recently had on our show, Matt Sutton. So we thank them for noting our podcast on their website, and we want to return the courtesy as well. So please check them out. Alrighty, let's get to today's topic. Over the past two decades, the world has witnessed the dramatic economic, political, and military rise of the People's Republic of China. As the world's most populous nation, it is not surprising that it would have been a formidable military in terms of sheer manpower, but then when you combine it with rapid technological and economic growth, there are many scholars and pundits who view China as a major threat to the hegemonic power of the United States in world affairs. Not surprisingly, a great deal of ink has been spilled on trying to predict what China will look like down the road in 10 years or so, and how that will affect the geopolitical environment. Perhaps one of the more underreported trends quietly shaping Chinese society, though, is the change in its religious landscape. Not only is China one of the world's most explosive economies, but it is also one of the most rapidly Christianizing nations in the world. Add to this increases in its Muslim and Buddhist populations, along with the phenomenal expansion of spiritual movements such as Falun Gong, and it should become readily apparent that social life in a China that has an aggressively secular communist government for the past six decades will certainly be much different in the future. About a year ago, our podcast series featured Professor Kerry Casel talking about this changing religious landscape and the issue of religious freedom in China. Since that time, Kerry has returned to China to conduct further fieldwork thanks to a generous grant from the Templeton Foundation's Pentecostal and Charismatic Research Initiative, which is directed by Don Miller at the University of Southern California. Her focus during 4 months in the field was to examine the growth of so-called house churches, specifically looking at how they can form, expand, and flourish under a political regime that often discourages independent religious expression. And so today, I am pleased to have Kerry return to the show to discuss what she found and prognosticate a little bit on how these religious changes might be affecting the social and political world in China. For folks that did not listen to our earlier broadcast with her, shame on you. What were you thinking? Well, nonetheless, we'll put the link up on our website so you can go back and review it. It was a great interview. In the meantime, I'd like to remind you that Kerry Casel is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Oregon, having recently finished her PhD at Cornell University. So, Kerry, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you, Tony.
So how was your trip back to China? How'd that go?
Yeah, it was wonderful. It's always great to be back in China, particularly this year, last fall was the Shanghai World Expo. So it was a very dynamic, exciting time to be in China, quickly changing, and it was wonderful to be back and supported by the Templeton Foundation and USC.
So did you get to hang out at the Shanghai World Expo?
I stood in line at the Shanghai Expo. It's about a four-hour wait to get into some of the exhibits. I think 10-hour was the longest wait, and it's a lot of time waiting.
Holy shnikey. That is quite a long time. What goes on in World Expo? You hear about them on TV, and Seattle here in the Pacific Northwest has the remnant of a former World Expo with that ugly space needle we have. But what was going on down there in their World Expo?
Well, countries from all around the world submit exhibits, which are essentially large buildings where they're putting on the best of their culture, economy, society. And so they're incredibly diverse, sort of celebrating or highlighting the strengths of cultures around the world.
Was there anything on religion there?
Some countries did bring religion into the aspect, various aspects of their exhibits, but I only had a chance to visit a few of them. I couldn't stand the lines for
it. Yeah.
The long wait.
Okay, well, let's move on to our topic today. And now, for those folks who have not heard your earlier podcast, and before we get into your more recent trip here to China and talk specifically about house churches, I think it'd be worth reviewing what religious life has been like and is like in the country. Now, shortly after the revolutionary takeover in 1949, the communist government in China undertook a pretty aggressive policy to squash almost all forms of political dissent, including religious activity, which was seen as counter-revolutionary. However, we saw in the 1980s and 1990s, China started to get a little bit limited political and economic thaw there, or perhaps the decompression. So could you give us a sense of how this history has affected religious life in the country over the last six decades or so?
Sure. Religion and the state in China have somewhat of a tense or antagonistic relationship, given the very different political projects of the Communist Party and religious groups. This begins in 1949 after the communists come to power and they put in certain measures. So foreign missionaries are kicked out of the country, religious universities and hospitals are taken over by the state, seminaries are closed, and you begin this long process of co-opting various religious communities. We really see the height of this in China during the Cultural Revolution, and so the mid-60s and 70s, where various anti-religious campaigns go into place, and religious communities, so everyday believers, religious leaders, and clergy are specifically targeted in these various campaigns. Temples are destroyed, mosques are destroyed, churches are torn down. Religious literature, Bibles, hymnals, Buddhist texts are burned in mass bonfires. And really we see religion, a complete sort of cease of religious life. People who don't denounce their religious beliefs during this time often keep them very private. So there are numerous stories coming out about folks during the Cultural Revolution, parents not telling their children that they were Buddhists or practicing Christians because they didn't want that type of information out there. It was just too politically sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
However, after Mao's death and Deng Xiaoping comes to power, you have the introduction of opening and reform, as you mentioned, and so as China is liberalizing and embracing market reforms in its economy, there's also important shifts or transformations in the religious policy. So in the 1980s, you have the Communist Party rethinking its stance on religion and beginning to allow more space for religious diversity. So temples and churches and mosques all across the country are beginning to rebuild and reopen. As a result of this, as a result of the state creating a little bit more space for religious expression, we begin to see what scholars have talked about as a very diverse and robust religious revival. Everything from Buddhism to shamanism to Taoism to Christianity as well as Islam.
Yeah, and now you've... You know, in talking about this, you've written that there are different levels of religious activity in China, ranging from the officially sanctioned churches, which I think the Communist Party in the 80s and 90s wanted to give some degree of sanctions to ones that are entirely illegal. Is that right?
Correct.
So give us a sense for that range of churches that are out there.
Okay. Well, within China, the religious marketplace is pretty complicated, and I think the most useful categorization has been one developed by Yang Fengang, which talks about the Chinese religious marketplace in three different markets. There's a red market, a black market, and a gray market. Now, within the red market, this is the officially state-sanctioned or state-approved marketplace. And so within this market, there's five official religions or five legal religions: Buddhism, Taoism, Islam, and Christianity is divided into Protestantism and Catholicism. So all of these five official religions in the red market are registered, legal, government recognized, and they have a government institution which helps manage them and organize them.
Now, how does a religious group gain this official sanction or registration?
There's various laws in place. The requirements are not really that different from what it would take a religious community in the U.S. to become maybe officially registered for tax status, and so they need a fixed place of worship and a fixed name. Citizens need to, the church or temple needs to be run by citizens, so Chinese citizens as believers. It needs to also be managed by Chinese citizens. A fifth requirement is that it needs to have some sort of legally or trained or recognized religious leadership, so a clergy, a minister, or a pastor who's had some kind of training. And the sixth requirement is that it needs to have a domestic source of legal income.
Mm-hmm.
And so if these six requirements are met, then the religious organization, such as a Protestant church, can affiliate with something called the Three Self Patriotic Movement, which is the official state-sanctioned or state-approved Church of China, and they can work their way through the registration process.
You know what? I'll come back to that self-patriotic movement in a second because I think that's kind of interesting here. One other question I have about some of these officially sanctioned churches, and that's not what we're going to be spending too much time on today. We want to look at some of the more clandestine ones. But for the official sanctioned churches, do you notice or have a sense that because they get an official sanction from the government that this affects their theological message or how they behave in public?
It's a great question, and my sense is actually no, that despite the fact that they are registered and have a stamp of approval by the government, that their theological message is in fact very independent. From what I've observed in the hundreds of services that I've attended is that there's a credible amount of diversity. It's not sort of a cookie-cutter approach to Christianity. And the variation really depends on the leadership of the church. You know, what is the message or the philosophy of the ministers or the laypersons in the church? What are the needs of the congregation? And so some churches have very demonstrative and enthusiastic services. Others spend a lot of emphasis on the choir is remarkable. And so there's a tremendous amount of variation. But in my own observations, you really don't see the state sort of meddling, particularly within the inner workings of the church.
Mm-hmm. How popular are these red market or officially sanctioned churches?
Extremely popular. In fact, there's a shortage, I would argue, of officially sanctioned churches in China. There just aren't enough buildings to meet the demand. So, for instance, services are usually held 5 to 6 days a week. Weekend services, there's numerous services, so they may be a 7 a.m. service, a 10 a.m. service, and an afternoon service. And what I found in attending many of the Three Self churches is that people make a weekend out of it. They attend religiously the 7 a.m. service, the 10 a.m. service, and the afternoon, and so they're there for the entire day.
I think this is actually a good time to talk a little bit about the Three Self Patriotic Movements before we move into the gray market and black market churches here, because we are talking about the official sanctioned churches. And you write a little bit about that in some of the work that you've done here. When was this organization, the Christian Three Self-Patriotic Movement, founded, and how has it changed over time, and how is it viewed now?
Sure, it's a great question. So the ideas of the Three Self-Patriotic Movement come from the late 20th century. But it was officially or formally organized in the 1950s. And the ideas behind it are three. Self-governance, which means that the Church of China will be led internally or domestically by Chinese citizens. Self-support, that the church should be independent from foreign intervention, particularly financially. And third, self-propagation, that the missionary work, the indigenous missionary work, should come from within China, not from without of China. So this is why it's often called the three-self church, because of these three core concepts of self-governance, self-support, and self-propagation. After it was formally organized in the 1950s, part of the rationale behind it was to demonstrate to the new regime, the new Communist Party, that Christians were also patriotic in the new political system, that they weren't opposed to the communists coming in to power. However, not all Christians in China at that time, not all Protestants in particular, were necessarily thrilled with the ideas behind the Three Self-Patriotic Movement or the Communist Party coming to power. So it wasn't universally supported among all Protestant communities. The controversies regarding the Three Self Church is some scholars have argued as well as some house church leaders in China, is that in many ways, because it is the officially sanctioned church of the Chinese Communist Party, it's become a handmaiden of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Others have said that it's been used to help persecute or track down house churches or house church leaders. My own opinion is that it's far more complicated than thinking of it as an agent of the state. It's a much more complicated story. It's essentially the legal church of China. The Three Self acts as a liaison between the state, so it's a bureaucratic organization. It also works in partnership with another bureaucracy called the China Christian Council, which runs more of the theological side of Protestantism in China, so mm-hmm. dealing with pastoral care and the publication of religious materials. And these two organizations, the Three Self Patriotic Movement and the China Christian Council, on the one hand, they are liaisons to the government, but at the other hand, they are run and staffed predominantly, in fact, overwhelmingly, by Protestants.
Okay, so the Catholic Church really has no link to this organization's.
No, and in fact, I should mention is that this is not, the idea of the Three Self Patriotic Movement is not unique to just Protestants. All of the five official religious organizations in China have their very similar bureaucratic structures that deal with management mm-hmm. and function as liaisons to the state as well as and religious communities.
And I would assume they have the same idea that it's really a domestic organization, because as you're talking about this, I know in China's history, you know, roughly 100 years leading up to the 1949 revolution, it was a great deal of imperialism that really created chaos within the country that led to the outbreak of the revolution in 1949. And so there'd be a great deal, naturally, of suspicion of foreigners meddling in affairs of the state, not only politically, but religiously. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct, that many of the ideas behind the Three Self were pushed forward by this idea of Western imperialism and driven by the Opium Wars, where often the case, or at least there's some stories, of missionaries being supportive of imperialist power.
Yeah, not surprising. Let's go ahead and move back to the different level of churches. Now, we covered the red market, which is obviously red market because of, you know, the Chinese Communist Party, the color is red. You mentioned two others, the gray market and black market. Let me move first to the black market churches. That, I think, will give us a little better sense of what gray market churches are. But what are the black market churches?
So black market churches are, the easiest way to think about them is this is the opposite or the other end of the spectrum of the red market. So these are churches, underground churches, that are not registered, and they don't register with the state for various reasons. It could be spiritual reasons. They don't like the idea of the state interfering or in religious activities. Perhaps they may be anti-Three Self Patriotic Movement, so you have some underground Protestants or unregistered churches who see the Three Self Patriotic Movement as being a part or an extension of the state. However, it can be more banal reasons that many house churches are unregistered. Lack of convenience. They could be a rural church, and there just isn't a Three Self Patriotic Church or Three Self Church nearby.
Mm-hmm.
Some may be actually have applied for registration, are in waiting. But the key about the black market is that these are unregistered religious communities, which means they have no legal protection or no legal status. Their activities are considered illegal by the state.
Now, what would happen if one of these illegal churches is discovered? What would happen to their members or to their leaders?
There's a wide variety of things that can happen. In many cases, nothing happens. So the public security bureaus may investigate the church to make sure that it is a legitimate religious institution and it's not necessarily a cult, and that the leaders of the church are not harming the members in any way. On the other extreme, one could arrest the ministers, imprison them, send them to labor camps, disband the congregation, confiscate the property. Often house churches have musical equipment or things like fax machines or copiers. This type of material will be confiscated. I think the more common trend, at least particularly in the past few years, has been indirect pressure. This is something that I've heard coming out, particularly in more urban areas, is that rather than the state directly intervening, they'll put indirect pressure on perhaps the landlord. So if a house church is renting an apartment or renting a room, then the Public Security Bureau will contact the landlord and pressure him or her to cancel the lease. And so it will be the landlord who will be pushing out or evicting the house church. Other instances I've heard that indirect pressure will come on individuals' employers. And so members of the congregation, their contact information would be collected by the state, and their employers would be contacted, and then their boss would be asked to lean on them, encouraging them to join an officially state-sanctioned church rather than participating in the black market churches.
Yeah, that's really interesting. First, the observation that they're putting pressure on landlords to evict them from their building, their apartment flat, their storefront, whatever it might be. I mean, that fits very well with work that I've been doing, and one of my individual concerns is that the issue of property rights is that once you take away a space, a physical space from a church, you really can limit how well it functions and how well it can grow. The other thing that is interesting, and for our listeners, I'm working off of a paper that Carrie provided me. It's a working paper that, based upon her research, and will probably go into other published forms at some point in time. You make this really interesting and ironic observation, is that when a lot of these church leaders in the past had been discovered illegally running a church, they would be sent to re-education camps or prisons somewhere. And what would happen was that they would actually start ministering to the other prisoners there. So it was a way of in many ways, propagating the faith even further. I assume that the government caught on to this and say, well, let's not do that anymore. Let's try the indirect pressure. Is that what's going on?
I think so. In many of the interviews I had with house church missionaries and leaders, when they were talking about their activities, particularly in the late 80s and early 90s, the common strategy would be to arrest them and send them to labor camps for re-education. And this wasn't necessarily as effective as perhaps the state may have liked. They often tried to create small house churches within clandestine churches within labor camps themselves, yeah. And once released, would continue their missionary activities.
Yeah, and plus the other people would be moving out in other paths as well when they left the labor camp, and so it's actually an interesting way to expand the church in many regards.
Somewhat ironic.
So one could see how that indirect pressure really plays a big role either on your employer or on your landlord. So there we're talking about house churches in that black market. I want to come back to the issue of house churches in a minute, but you mentioned a third layer of churches, and this fits between the red and the black markets, and something known as the gray market. What do we mean by that?
Sure. So the gray market is this somewhat ambiguous space between the red and the black markets. And I think the gray market, the easiest way to think about this is what really matters is the relationship between the local government and the various religious communities. And so here you might have local governments giving a somewhat tacit approval to a house church. So they may be allowing a house church to organize and then looking the other way with the idea that the local government knows about them, it realizes that they're not a threat, and it's allowing them to organize and to hold their worship services so long as they remain small and non-confrontational. And this is not just among Protestant groups, but in various parts of China, local governments have also established good relations with other unregistered religious communities. So in the far northeast of China, where there historically has been a small Russian Orthodox population, you have the local government approving and officially registering small Russian Orthodox churches, so it allows them to function, it allows them to worship, even though they fall out of the five official religions of the state.
Mm-hmm.
In coastal China, in Fujian province, which is right across from Taiwan, you have a local goddess. Her name is Mazu. She protects the Taiwanese Strait, and she also doesn't fit into one of these five official religions, but because she has such a strong historical pull in the region, And she's remarkably popular, not only in Fujian province, but also in Taiwan. And so she acts as this sort of cultural ambassador to the Taiwan Straits area. So the local government has been remarkably supportive of her festivals and temple activities. And so it's this gray, ambiguous area where local governments sort of, you know, keep one eye open and the other eye closed to religious communities. They don't actively suppress them, and they allow them to continue their religious activities with some degree of freedom so long as they remain small and not a public disturbance.
Yeah, that was one of the great observations that you made in the last podcast that you did with us. And it's another one of these ironies of the Chinese political system. Even though it's highly centralized, you made the argument that a lot of church-state relations are really managed at the local level, giving local bureaucrats the ability to change things or do things as they see fit, either officially or somewhat regards on the sly in that regard. So I want to, again, refer our listeners back to that earlier conversation that we had. We'll link to it on our website. So if you're interested in this topic, get filled in more on that one. What I wanted to talk most about today is this issue of house churches that are primarily in the black market, but, you know, bleed into the gray market a little bit. And that term house church has really become popular in a lot of circles recently, talking about religious liberty, talking about missionary activity and such. What is a house church?
Well, I think the easiest definition is that these are unregistered churches that are operating in either the black or the gray market. So they're autonomous, which means they're not tied to the three self-patriotic churches. They often hold services in private. They have no legal protections, and they support activities that are often considered illegal by the state. They also don't hold services in recognizable structures. So these are private people's homes, sometimes rented out restaurants, movie theaters. In rural areas, it could be a barn. It could be outside at a park or a field. So it's not a recognizable building, or it's not a recognizable church where these activities are taking place. I should also mention that the house church movement has been receiving quite a bit of notoriety, particularly in the Western press, and this is a very diverse community. Mm-hmm. Some house churches are very large and public. Others are quite small and clandestine. There's also no single leadership structure, so it's not being managed or organized or overseen by one organization or one small group. It's not a unified movement, but incredibly diverse and fragmented community.
You know, one of the interesting things that I found in your paper is the size, or the variation in size of these house churches. When I hear the term house church, I think, oh, it's, you know, meeting maybe 25, 30, 40 people. As you mentioned, sometimes these are in movie theaters, so it could be a little bit larger. But some of these house churches that you talk about have thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands, and possibly even above a million members in these things. So these can get pretty big, is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a diverse network, and so the actual services are often held in very small groups, 20 to 30 people, some up to 100, maybe even larger. But they may be tapped into a larger network, so they would identify with a certain house church, which may have up to a million members. Some scholars estimate maybe, you know, 2 to 3 million members may be the size of some of the very largest house churches in China. But generally, these are small, atomized congregations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, it's amazing to think about the organizational structure. We're going to talk about that in a second, to operate clandestinely but still have a very large organization that networks across a pretty big territory, I would assume. That some of these house churches that have more than a 500,000 members are operating in many different parts of the country. So absolutely fascinating. Now, are these house churches largely a rural phenomena? Because that tends to be the image we get here in the West.
Certainly. I think it's both urban and rural. Some of the scholarship, early literature on house churches talks about, particularly focuses on the rural growth in the 1980s and 90s, and I think this is where folks watching China began to see the explosion of house churches most predominantly, perhaps because it was less regulated than cities, in the 80s and 90s. But as the Chinese population is migrating, particularly from rural areas to more urban locations, there has been a movement of house churches, particularly some of the rural churches, are moving into a more urban marketplace. But there are also distinctly urban churches run by intellectuals, some maybe attached to universities, with very urban educated populations. And so it is an incredibly diverse movement, both rural and urban.
Now, is it possible to give us a sense of how a house church can get established in this environment and how it might expand and operate on a daily basis? I mean, you're in the field there and you saw this kind of stuff. So what are you observing?
Sure. I can give you an interesting example of perhaps a rural house church growth.
Please do.
So several missionaries who used to work in the countryside explained to me that they would join small missionary teams, two, maybe up to four individuals, and they would go around proselytizing in various villages, sort of from village to village. They would work in the fields and try to plant churches along the way. So during the day, they would be tilling the fields with the other peasants, and in the evening, they would invite them to services and introduce them to the Bible in a much more a fundamental way. Usually, these missionary teams could stay in a village 2 weeks, and that would be, they estimated, a significant enough time to sort of plant a church, and then they would move on to the next location. And this would allow the church to sort of develop independently on its own.
Hmm. I guess that brings me to an interesting question. Is there any theological commonality amongst these house churches? And when you talk about, you know, a missionary will stay 2 to 3 weeks and then plant a church and then take off, I'm starting to think that, wow, you know, that's not a whole lot of training that you leave somebody behind with. And I could only imagine there's going to be a wide variety of styles as well as theological emphases on this stuff.
I think you're absolutely right. In the rural churches that I've studied, they tend to be leaning towards more Pentecostal and charismatic activities.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily self-identify as Pentecostal or charismatic, but many of the services, so there's prophecy, speaking in tongues, faith healing. These are very important components of their church, which would fall closely in line with a more Pentecostal and charismatic services around the world.
Mm-hmm.
More urban churches, particularly run by intellectuals, are, I would say, in my observations, are less Pentecostal and charismatic and more evangelical. These are much more based on scripture and sort of an intellectual discussion of the Bible, as opposed to much more demonstrative or active services.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation, because when we think about Pentecostalism worldwide, and you're part of this research agenda with the Templeton Foundation or the Templeton Fund looking at Pentecostalism in various parts of the world, is that Pentecostalism or charismatic Christianity really lends itself to rapid expansion and that kind of really emotive or emotional connection to the Gospels rather than a deeply, you know, thought through intellectual type of theology. That more emotional aspect really is very useful for expanding quite rapidly, for training missionaries, because once you get filled with the Spirit, you can go on, as compared to having to train in a seminary for 5 or 6 years or so.
Absolutely. And in missionaries that I interviewed who were planting churches in rural China, they often spoke about this emotional aspect of the church, particularly faith healing, laying hands on somebody and casting out demons, as well as the importance of miracles, that these two factors have been very fundamental in encouraging the church to grow at such phenomenal rates, particularly across different parts of rural China.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the churches that you focused your research on is something that we're going to just call simply the Fellowship. That's not its actual name, because, again, this house church is actually somewhat clandestine, operating in the gray and black markets that exist in the religious landscape there. Now, you mentioned that this church has well over 500,000 members. Now, that's a pretty big house for a house church to have that many members. Give us some sense of that, to the level of detail that you can, of how this thing was founded and how it remains under the radar, yet able to grow to such massive proportions.
Sure. The church that I've been studying, which we're calling the Fellowship, is quite interesting. It begins in the 1980s in central China, and it's a rural church, and it's had tremendous growth, with estimates, you know, well over 500,000 members at this point. And it has been successful in planting churches in all provinces in China. It also has missionaries that are active abroad, so missionaries in the Middle East and Southeast Asia. And I think one of the keys to the success of their growth is that although the church itself is quite large, the actual services, the meeting groups, are very small. And so the worship services are 20 to 30 members in small house churches, or often even smaller groups, which they call cell groups. So by keeping these small groups, they're able to, you know, sort of slide under the radar. They don't have official buildings. They meet in houses. They meet sometimes outside or in barns. And unless you're personally invited to the church, it's difficult to find them. They are such small communities, and it allows them to sort of function in the shadows without increasing a greater amount of risk for themselves.
Personal invitation, that's an interesting observation because, again, when you're operating in a clandestine level, you never know who's going to show up. And so I can imagine that members of these churches do a little bit of spying. I don't know if that's the exact word, but perhaps probing of individuals just on a casual basis at work or at a restaurant or places that people meet, and just to kind of figure out, is that what is going on?
I think that definitely is the case. And so people are invited into the community once they feel like they're not necessarily a threat or that someone within the organization can vouch for them. However, I often did hear stories of they know when someone is invited into the community and perhaps maybe which they considered a spy trying to infiltrate the church. And the funny story which kept reoccurring is many of the house church ministers said that they actually converted the person in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
And so they became a friend to the church and wanted to demonstrate that their church was not against the regime and, in fact, very pro-China. And so people who came into the organization to spy on it originally became active participants in the church itself.
Yeah, that again, is fascinating. I can just see the strategic game here, that if you're a member of the Communist Party and you want to figure out where some of these house churches are operating, you send somebody out to, you know, perhaps give signals in a public place or in a workplace and say, oh, maybe you'll get invited to one of these house churches, and you show up to it and, you know, do a little spy. And then you show up and you're all of a sudden like, hey, this is pretty cool. I mean, again, one of the ironies, right, is a way of trying to maybe cap or control the growth of some of these places. You actually are creating an environment which actually enhances the growth.
Absolutely.
Wow. That's kind of interesting. And how, you know, in speaking of this one church, the Fellowship, again, not its real name, does the government know that this thing exists? Is this operating in the gray market, or is this an entirely black market operation?
I would say certainly the government knows that they exist.
Yeah.
And in some local governments, the house churches have very good relationships. Certainly the central government knows that it exists, and because it is spread out all across China, in some parts of China it has very close relationships with not only local authorities, but also the three self-churches.
Mm-hmm.
In other places, the relationship can be a bit more tense. What's interesting about the Fellowship is they don't like this idea of being a secret or clandestine organization. They're doing this sort of out of survival tactics. They would much prefer to be registered with the state and to be above ground and to be able to build actual churches where they could invite people to without meeting in private homes. However, they don't want to register with the three self-churches. At least that's the stance at this point. And so they're forced to be in this gray, black, ambiguous zone.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me quite a bit of the early church growth in Christianity for roughly the first 200 to 300 years or so, where it had that tense relationship. But again, you know, local pockets that you can find a friendly space to grow in can can really help you. And again, that goes back to the point that you were making, you know, earlier in this podcast and more extensively in your previous one, that those local relations really matter quite a bit. Even in a very centralized communist hierarchy, that local relations still matter quite a bit. I want to get to your thesis, and we're already touching upon some elements of this, of how they expand and in a minute here, but I want to take a step sideways and ask you about your methodology, or I guess that's a fancy way of saying how you go about doing this, because, you know, not only am I interested in your findings, but I think myself and a number of listeners would be interested in, you know, how do you go about investigating something that is in this gray and black market as a scholar? How do you do that?
That's a great question. You're right that religion is still somewhat of a sensitive topic, in spite growing liberalization and opening in China. However, I would say it's a far cry. It's much easier to study religion in China now than it was 3 decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
Religion in the past, in the 1980s and before that, if it was studied at a university, it was often housed in the philosophy department under Marxist-Leninist-Maoist ideology. So you can imagine that the scholarship coming out of these departments was dealing with how do we eradicate religion, when is religion going, when will secularism triumph and religion will fade away. Now, however, there has been a shift, partially, I think, because the realization that religion is not going away, and this is something we need to study more systematically and more intensively. And so the Chinese government has put quite a bit of money into building and founding religious studies programs across China. So several universities now have religious studies programs where the intellectual space has opened, which allows scholars to study religion in a much more open environment. Nevertheless, China is still a non-democratic regime, and so there can be certain difficulties, particularly when you're studying groups that function in these gray and black markets. So as I mentioned before, personal introductions are very important. It's difficult, if not impossible, to find a house church without being personally invited into the community. But you could walk by a Taoist temple or a Catholic church in China, and you can walk in, poke around, and possibly get an interview with a priest. For groups that are functioning on the political margins, you do need some type of personal introduction.
So how did you go about doing that? I mean, just kind of walking around and saying, you know, hello, I'm the American here studying religion. Somebody please invite me into their clandestine house church. I mean, it's fascinating to me that you're able to do this. And so how do you do that?
My own strategy, I tried a few different approaches. One is that in a previous project, I had been studying above-ground churches, the three self-churches and official religious communities in China. And in my interviews, I often asked various Protestant ministers what they thought about the house church movement, what they thought about these groups. Did they see them as competition, or did they see them also as brothers and sisters? And several of the ministers, which were much more open and supportive of house churches, offered to introduce me to somebody who belongs to a house church to help my research project. They said, you know, if you do want to understand the development and growth of Protestantism and Christianity in China, you should study the three self-churches, but you should also get a glimpse into some of the house churches. And so it's just started for me with one personal introduction, and then it's somewhat snowballed from there.
Yeah, I guess that's part of the research process, that it can have this serendipitous aspect to it, that you know, you get invited to talk to somebody else, and you're like, oh, there's a different research avenue. That door has really opened to me, and you know, you've had excellent training in doing this, and so you knew exactly how to basically capitalize on that type of opportunity. And you know, again, getting the grant from the Templeton Foundation really, you know, bolstered your ability to do that. Let me go ahead now and get to your main thesis here of the working paper that you allowed me to read. And again, this hasn't been published yet, and you're still working on it. So, you know, folks, our listeners will just have to wait until it does come out in published form, but we'll give you some preview of it here. You make a really interesting case for your thesis here, and that the basic thesis is that these house churches tend to expand the same way that the Communist Party, Mao's Communist Party, expanded in the 1930s and 1940s. Now, this might come as a shock to some folks saying, well, the Communist Party is very different than these religious groups. But, you know, as I always like to say, just because you're part of a religious organization, you're not exempt from the realities of society and building organizations and that people free ride and all these kind of things. So give us an indication of what is going on here. What is your thesis that you link these two, one would seem completely opposite movements, together in their organizational strategies and tactics?
Okay. Well, one thing that I discovered in my research quite unexpectedly when talking to church leaders and church members about how their organization has been able to grow to well over 500,000 members in over 3 decades, particularly because they're functioning in this gray and black market, one thing that repeatedly came up is the power of organization and how organizational strategies are essential for growth. And so the church that I was studying, the fellowship, one thing that they mentioned is that although they have a leader and district churches and a leadership council at the top of their hierarchy, the further they go down on their organizational structure, so the lower to the bottom of the pyramid, the more fragmented and disaggregated the church becomes itself. So you have thousands of independent house churches, which are all tied into the network, but these are very small groups of 20 or 30 members. And then house churches are further broken down into cell groups, which would be equivalent of a Bible study group. So you may have a women's Bible study group or a youth organization. But these are small groups of 5 to 7, sometimes 10 individuals. And the catch with the house churches and the cell group is that because they're smaller, they're more clandestine, so they're harder to detect from the state. They integrate members more deeply because they are intimate communities and they can sort of meet the local needs of the congregation. They also have the advantage is that they are loosely connected to one another. And so if one is raided, the larger organizational structure of the church remains intact. Or at the same time, if a leader, a higher level in the church is arrested, then the integrity of the organization is preserved because the lower organization, which is the base of it, is really much wider and much more autonomous than various levels higher up the hierarchy. And so one of the striking things I found in my research is that despite the fact that the early communists and underground Protestants have very different political or spiritual agendas or missions, these are organizations which are functioning in the shadows. Certainly the communists were in their own struggles for power. They were targets of state repression. They're competing for members. And so Lenin often talked about the organizational weapons, about how the organizational structure is the most important weapon of the proletariat, that you need to have these smaller cell groups, this fractal organization, that if it is raided, if it is attacked, the larger integrity will persevere. And so in many ways, the organizational structure of the church has paralleled that of the communists. And when I asked church leaders about this irony, they said, well, yes, indeed, we have modeled ourselves in many ways after the early communists. It's a good example. It's a successful example. It's a local or domestic example of something that works for religious groups or communist groups, political groups on the margins of how to operate and succeed and grow in restrictive political contexts.
I'm glad you got that response from some of the house church leaders, because it oftentimes is a hard sell among academics. I've had the same experience that when I started studying the Catholic Church or Protestant churches in Latin America, I studied it from a more organizational perspective, and I got a lot of criticism from colleagues around the country saying, no, no, you know, you can't apply the theories that apply to business firms or to secular NGOs, to religious groups, because it's something really different. And I thought we were always selling ourselves short by neglecting the more mundane aspects of church organization by thinking everything is driven by some high-minded theology and such. And when I went and talked to Catholic bishops and Protestant missionaries in Latin America, one of the things, just like you did, I'd say, well, you know, isn't this kind of weird that you're organized in this kind of very secular way that other secular organizations have followed throughout history? And they go, yeah, I mean, that's just simple organizational life. And we do think about high-minded theological issues, but, you know, we essentially have to, you know, get people into the pews. We have to find a place to meet and pay the electric bill and all those kind of things. And that matters quite a bit for church growth. It's not just theological aspects.
Absolutely.
Let's go ahead and finish up here by engaging in a little bit of prognostication. And I have this nasty habit of asking this on the podcast. I know most scholars worth their weight in salt will always try not to predict things about the future because we know that we are often wrong. And, you know, when that stuff is caught on tape, people are going to come back and point to us and say, ha, 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 what do you know? But I'm throwing caution to the wind here. And we opened our podcast with an introduction thinking about how this growth in Christianity and other religious movements, Falun Gong, Islam, and Buddhism, might impact China. And so I want to collect your thoughts on that issue. You've, you know, for several trips to China, working intimately with these groups and being amongst the society and even attending the World Expo, you've gotten a sense for maybe the pulse of society and how these religious changes are affecting that society. So give us some of your thoughts there.
So what would China be like in the future? You know, it is a little nerve-wracking to predict the future. I think one thing certainly, we will continue to see the decline of ideology, Marxism and Leninism and Maoism. People, the public or the masses just aren't buying into it anymore, and the party will continue to play lip service, but will reinvent itself, remaining in power. I don't see the Communist Party going away, but I see it continuing to adapt, reinvent itself, and perhaps drawing on new political ideologies. There's been some discussion of an embrace of Confucianism as sort of a cultural ideology or philosophy, which will be used as a guiding principle, focusing on particularly on harmony as well as order and stability, which are very much the mantras of the party these days.
Yeah, and that's really ironic because some of the earlier reactions by some of the founders of the communist movement was really a reaction against Confucianism.
Absolutely, and just as religious groups were persecuted during the Cultural Revolution, certainly there was an anti-Confucius campaign that was targeted. And so now Confucius has been rehabilitated. In fact, last year, there was a large statue of Confucius, which was placed in Tiananmen Square.
Mm.
And so he has made a comeback.
Wow.
As for the nature of religion and religious revival in China, I think we'll continue to see religion growing, but perhaps maybe not as at the remarkable pace that it has been for the past few decades. A survey came out a few years ago in China, a government-sponsored survey, that said there's an estimated about 300 million religious believers of all stripes in China, which is a very large number, but that works out to be about 30% of the population in China. So considerably smaller percent of the total population. Nevertheless, 300 million is a large number when you consider that there's about 75 million Communist Party members. So religious believers of various confessions are certainly outnumbering members of the Communist Party. But I wouldn't predict that China would become you know, a Christian nation or a Buddhist nation in the next decade. I think that's 10 years is certainly too short.
Yeah. Do you see these Christian movements, these house church movements, and these other religious movements as really facilitating greater political opening within the country?
It's a great question. I think, you know, only time will tell. But in my own research and the house church movements that I've mentioned or I've been studying, because I'm a political scientist, I also often ask them about where they see China and the politics of China changing in the 10 years, and do they see their movement as becoming a political organization and a force for political change, as we saw other religious groups, such as the Catholic Church, in the collapse of communism in Poland. Mm-hmm. And the overwhelming answer is no, absolutely not. We're a spiritual organization. We have no political ambitions. We have no political mission. We would like greater religious freedom, but right now things are pretty good. Things are getting better. And what also comes up in this discussion is that the house church, particularly the one that I'm studying, sees itself as very pro-China, as very patriotic. They may not necessarily like all aspects of the Communist Party, but they're not an anti-regime party in any stretch of the imagination. In fact, most services begin with specific prayers for China, as well as the atheist Communist Party members.
Mm-hmm. That's an important lesson to keep in mind, too. And you mentioned the Poland case, where the Catholic Church was very active in working against the communist regime there. And we tend to get a sense, especially us as political scientists, we want everything to have some kind of overtly political meaning. It's very easy for us to forget that most people go to church for church, not for political reasons, and that there's that really spiritual aspect to that. And so, you know, again, this is, we shouldn't be expecting that these religious movements are going to be outwardly political, or that we should put a lot of our poker chips on them as being a major force for change in these regimes. Yet nonetheless, as you mentioned, they're interested in little things that we might not consider to be all that important, but just changes in religious liberty, just being able to get a building here or a building there, or not to have to worry about the local government butting into their business in that regard. And sometimes those small changes can make fairly big changes within society over time, and some things that we tend to overlook. Any thoughts on that?
I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, if you pick up a newspaper in the U.S., the New York Times or Wall Street Journal, often we see somewhat sensational stories about suppression of house churches, and the articles end by talking about perhaps this will be a force of resistance and that it will challenge the party. But in many ways, the people attending house churches just want a place to worship, and they would like maybe a building, as you said. They would like to have a little bit more autonomy or religious liberty, but they don't see themselves with a political mission. Certainly their leaders don't, and members of the congregation, I would argue, probably even less so.
Mm-hmm. Well, that issue of religious liberty that you brought up reminds me that next week we're going to be having a special podcast on this with a former diplomat who worked in the State Department on religious liberty issues, and that man is Thomas Farr. And so, folks interested in issues of religious liberty, I urge you to tune into that podcast next week. And if you know of people who are interested in this topic, religion in China or issues of religious liberty or anything in general, we ask you to really spread the word about our podcast. We are starting to grow in our listener audience, and we're very excited about that. We are now on Facebook. We have a Facebook page that you can find us under. It's under Research on Religion with Anthony Gill. And we encourage you to go and like us on that page so that you can get weekly updates, so that you can hear great guests like Thomas Farr, who we'll be having next week. And of course, this week we had Carrie Casel. And Carrie, I want to really thank you once again for being on the show. You're a great guest to have on. And I think as your research progresses, we're going to ask you back and see what's continuing to happen in China.
My pleasure. I would be delighted to come back.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.